Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Politics may safely be called the medium for the theory and practice of social change. The implementation of social change is the topic of this edition of Radio Curious. Our guest is Norman Solomon, founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy, based in San Francisco, California, and Washington, D.C. He's been its director since 1999. Norman Solomon is currently a candidate for Congress from California for the newly formed 2nd Congressional District that includes the coastal counties of Northern California from the Golden Gate Bridge, 350 miles north to the Oregon border. In addition to his work at the Institute for Public Accuracy, Norman Solomon has written 12 books on politics, civil disobedience, and war. When Norman Solomon was barely 17 years old, he came to believe that it was possible to do almost anything with enough desire. At that time, he also wanted to write a book, which he then called No Compromise. Norman Solomon visited the studios of Radio Curious on February 2, 2012. We began our conversation when I asked him if he ever wrote that book.
Only in my head, only in the desire to be transformative, I suppose, change my own life for the better. And, you know, with the pluses and minus of youth, having the belief that, you know, one could just change almost anything, which I think is a double-edged sword.
Tell us about your attempts to change things and how they came out.
Well, initially, I was drawn to trying to change the school that I went to, junior high or high school, you know, beginning with the most immediate and, you know, in retrospect, small things like, you know, one-way staircases or not liking the way that students were treated day to day. But living in what we, I guess, would consider a border state of Maryland in the mid-1960s, the civil rights movement began to really make a difference to me. I lived near a whites-only apartment complex, and first time I went on a picket line was in early 1966 at age 14 to desegregate the apartment. And at that point, it was a beginning, in retrospect, of a very long process of looking at issues of civil rights, which really are human rights issues, civil liberties, challenging war. And unfortunately, we've had several decades of war since the mid-1960s with the U.S. directly involved. Environmental issues. I spent years working to shut down a nuclear power plant in Oregon in the 1970s. And through writing, speaking, and organizing, I've really been engaged in that process, which I think as an individual can be very dispiriting and discouraging. But a lot of where I get my juice and encouragement is to keep engaged with so many other people. And that's really the difference. If we look at ourselves, and unfortunately a lot of writers and artists may look at ourselves as the individual out to change the world, then hey, it's not going to work very well. But if we grasp more of a group process and coalition building, ongoing effort to really tap into and strengthen social movements, then it's more a matter of what can we do rather than what can I do.
You said that making change was a double-edged sword. What do you mean by that? What are the two edges?
Well, I think the enthusiasm and high goals of a young person, certainly for me and others, is that, gee, you know, we can do almost anything, which I think is a wonderful approach. All too often, there's this tendency to think, well, as in the case of politics, politics is the art of the possible, and possible is just defined very narrowly. And it's one of the blessings of being young, I think, that quite often there's a sense of, hey, we just got here. We see what is right and what is wrong, what we believe in, what we passionately care for and about, and we can make a difference. I think that's wonderful and really historically and in the present time, the lifeblood of a vibrant body politic to take a fresh look, to say, let's not be bound by the old, what is the quote from Shakespeare? We ask, what is not and what can be, rather than be confined. But the double-edged sword is that it's often ahistorical. It's like walking into a movie midway through and not understanding there's a context, and that you can't just change social conditions because you want to and you think they should go away or transform.
What was your family of origin's orientation towards political action?
Both of my parents were liberal Democrats. They had met, actually I was named after Norman Thomas. They'd met at a socialist meeting at Brooklyn College. They were anti-communist and believed in the vision of social equity, civil rights, labor rights, and an egalitarian society. So that was the ambience I grew up in. At the same time, the civil rights movement was a unifying factor, but the anti-war movement really was not, because the radicalism of the New Left was not exactly totally comfortable for my parents, not to mention the long hair and marijuana.
So the anti-war movement goes back to the 60s and 70s and the Vietnam protest.
Yeah, I went to my first demonstration against the Vietnam War in April 1967. I took a train from D.C. to New York. I think there were 150,000 people there. Martin Luther King spoke, as I recall, at UN Plaza, but the march was so large that by the time we got there, the speeches had been over.
And at that time, you were about 15 years old.
Yeah, that's right.
The question that I want to ask has to do with your perspective on civil disobedience and how it's changed the history of the United States, beginning with the Boston Tea Party, the anti-slavery movement, the suffrage movement, the union movements, the civil rights movements, the anti-war movements. Can you comment about that?
One of my heroes is George Seldes, the great media critic. I got to meet him when he was a young 96 years old. He wrote a book titled Never Tire of Protesting. And here's a journalist, media critic, who recognized that one of the motor forces of history for the good is protest by any other name. And so when we think about everything that we can be proud of in our country in terms of government policies and social change, at the root, there's been the capacity and the willingness and the imperative that people have recognized to protest. And nonviolence to me is a practicality. It's not a mere platitude. Violence is a tool of suppression and repression. It's understood, and there's a lot of enthusiasm from power structures. I mean, the Pentagon is the most violent entity on the planet, given its capacities. And going to the Pentagon at protests, as I have done at times, as so many have done, it's really striking how violence is an entity that those in power know how to encounter and deal with. The economic and political military power structure can counter violence with more violence. It's what Gandhi called soul force, satyagraha, that mobilizes a different sort of human capacity. And I think that while sometimes social protest in this country has moved into, and I would say strayed into, violence, at the core of constructive, history-changing protest has been a commitment to human witnessing and challenging of dire conditions. And that's encouraging to me. When we read a history book like Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, the chronicle of resistance, usually nonviolent, not always, to repression is always inspiring. And it's not in the front pages, it's not explained very often to our own public, but that's what's changed our world for the better.
Subsequently, after some time in college, university, you moved your work into what is euphemistically called a think tank. Tell us about that.
Well, a long winding road. I suppose the think tank was first, even before the internet existed, sort of virtual, in that I worked with a lot of people from my own area in the country and around the nation to figure out how we could develop a theory and practice of social change. And then more literally, in the late 1990s, I founded the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is a sort of a think tank. It's now in its 15th year, and for 13 of those years, I was founding executive director. And it was essentially a pro bono public relations advocacy agency for literally thousands of progressive organizers, activists, writers, academics, whose voices are rarely heard in the mass media. So for that decade and a half, we've worked as a virtual think tank, you might say, to get those voices out. And I'm really glad to say that the qualitative wealth of knowledge, understanding, analysis, and articulation from around this country and beyond has really reached so many millions of people every month because of our ongoing efforts. Certainly on Pacifica's airwaves, many other outlets have benefited from us basically saying several times a week with news releases, this is the breaking news that you can have these experts talk about. And those experts are made available not because they have a lot of money, not because of corporate backing or because they parrot the so-called conventional wisdom, but because they have expertise and perspectives to offer that run against a conventional power structure grain.
What are the areas or the topics of the expertise that is offered?
Well, really, it would be almost easier to, and certainly more concise, to say the areas that aren't covered, because we've been very multi-issue. And in retrospect, that's been great training for me as executive director and editor of thousands of news releases on almost any public issue you can imagine, from healthcare to education to housing to tax policy to nuclear weapons and military intervention and fighting poverty at home and abroad, civil liberties issues. And we've been working with so many people. It's really given me a sense of it's a beautiful and also disturbing reality that there are so many people with so much to bring to the table in terms of their understanding and analysis and recommendations, and they're rarely heard in mass media, and they're discounted from inside the Beltway, and they're kept out of the decision-making process in Washington to an inordinate degree. So these issues are all interrelated. As the great ecologist Barry Commoner said, all things are connected. And in this think tank, so to speak, the Institute for Public Accuracy, which, by the way, is on the web at accuracy.org, we now are almost 15 years into sharing that expertise in real time with people as breaking news breaks.
So your role as the executive director, during that time, perhaps before and after, you wrote about 12 books. Was that part of your role?
Yeah, I founded the group and then oversaw and coordinated our operation in the National Press Building in Washington, D.C., as well as an administrative office in San Francisco. And constantly, I worked with our small staff to identify news that was breaking, was important, should be dealt with, and to identify and contact and summarize, usually through quotation and so forth, from experts who could really shed some light. And that meant we constantly had to think about, well, there's intervention in this part of the world, or there's a new unemployment report, or there's an environmental disaster unfolding. What can we bring to the national or international discourse that will add to what's already being shared? And quite often, we're a contrast. The Institute for Public Accuracy shares information and understanding that just is so different than the routine, homogenized, mass-produced what passes for news in our own U.S. mass media, that quite often is manufactured by PR agencies or government officials.
Can you give us some specific examples of those differences?
Sure. There's a new unemployment report, the conventional wisdom from the economists who are brought into TV and radio would be, we need to stimulate the economy by reducing the deficit, by assisting small businesses and large businesses to be able to hire more. Whereas we've popularized, helped to propagate the views of economists such as Mark Weisbrot and Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who have been quite prophetic. And so, for instance, we were at the time of the big bubble for the NASDAQ, for tech industry, we were providing their analysis, saying this bubble is going to burst.
This was in the 1990s.
Exactly. And then after that, while there was all this enthusiasm about the housing boom and so forth, Dean Baker was saying through our news releases, you know, this housing bubble's going to burst. And again, we were running against the conventional wisdom. And more generically, we challenged the deficit hawks' analysis that the federal deficit is the big economic problem. We talk about the drivers of runaway healthcare costs with pharmaceutical, hospital, and insurance industries making a killing. We talk about the way in which high unemployment is so terrible for the society, and that you can't depend on trickle-down economics or trickle-down job creation. We need huge federal jobs programs to bring down the unemployment rate. Well, that's sort of, if not heretical, at least very much against the usual that's coming out of the mass media.
I want to know about some of the current predictions that the Institute for Public Accuracy is making now. But first, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Norman Solomon, who in the past has been the executive director and founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy, based in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. He's also a candidate for Congress in the newly shaped 2nd California Congressional District that runs from the north side of the Golden Gate Bridge along the coast of California to Oregon. There's no incumbent in this district, and it's an open race. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Norman, what are some of the current predictions from the Institute for Public Accuracy?
Well, we don't put too fine a point in it. You know, I like to say our crystal ball's in the shop pretty much permanently, but we do see the consequences of these massive giveaways to Wall Street. And so our anticipation, if not prediction, tends to be unfortunately downbeat, because we try to be realists, that this obsession with the deficit, this failure of the federal government to provide the necessary funding to cities, counties, the state, as in California and elsewhere in the country, has dire negative consequences. It's a spiral downward which continues. We have localities around the country that have a bad budget one year and a worse budget the next year. And so to the extent we would predict, we would say that unless these priorities can be turned around, high unemployment is going to remain, high underemployment will remain, and public schools, for instance, will continue to be on a downward trend. And on the plus side, we see that if there's not only what's called a vigorous stimulus program, but a reorientation away from simply tax cuts for businesses and the wealthy and somewhat for middle class, that if we can just not rely on that, but move forward into the equivalent of a Green New Deal, we do advocate that instead of prioritizing the profits of Wall Street, we engage in massive public investment, and only the federal government can do that. The states can't do it. The cities, the counties can't do deficit spending. Without deficit spending, we never could have had a New Deal. And now the only way to turn this economy around that will really help people at the grassroots widespread is to do public investment massively.
And what would that be? How would we see that on a material plane in our district and in our nation?
For people, it would mean that teachers are being rehired, that bridges and roads are being repaired rather than left to further deteriorate, that public transit projects would be implemented and expanded, that it wouldn't be a nickel and dime operation to say we need light rail for commuters in our community. There would be job creation in terms of restoration of the fisheries and the forests and the rivers, and people would not be chasing jobs. Jobs would be chasing people. It's not a fantasy. There's a reality of history that the New Deal created upwards of 11 million new jobs during the Depression. That could be done now, but it requires a political will. And that's one of the geniuses of the Occupy movement, is to identify the huge gaps between rich and the rest of us and the necessity for us to challenge Wall Street power and implement democratic decision-making so that the bulk of the population benefits.
Let's talk about populism for a moment and how it's now being manifested in Congress.
Populism, I think, historically and in the present day, has had two pathways. There's usually a fork in the road. People are angry. especially in times of economic distress like now, you can't convince people not to be enraged if they're enraged. So the anger classically takes either a right-wing form, which is the Tea Party, blame those who are already suffering from inequities, immigrants, low-income people, fail to blame those who are benefiting from the inequities, such as Wall Street, such as the military-industrial complex. Well, that's a sort of a nativist, xenophobic, right-wing response of a sort of populism to dire economic straits. There is another path, which is progressive populism, which rather than blaming victims of inequity, engages in solidarity with, bonds with, organizes with, and on behalf of low-income people, immigrants who are suffering, actually the 99% at this point. And the Tea Party is really a reflective response that doesn't reflect enough. Representatives in Congress are either reflecting a sort of a right-wing xenophobia, a populism that is based on anger but doesn't have a clear understanding of why so much inequity exists, or we've got progressives in Congress who are trying to manifest, I think, a constructive sort of a populism. And that's a tension. It's a tension on Capitol Hill and in the country at large. I think of the film, The Grapes of Wrath, where the people in the big black car drive up to kick the Jode family off of their farm, and grandpa's waving a rifle and wants to shoot him. And his grandson, I think, says, you can't shoot them. And he says, well, they're trying to kick us off the land. And the offspring, the younger, says, well, yeah, but they're just working for the bank in Chicago. And so grandpa says, well, we'll go to Chicago and we'll shoot them. He says, no, well, they're just working for the bank in New York. He says, well, then who do I shoot? You know, and metaphorically, that is the quandary of people who are enraged at their economic circumstances, again, figuratively. Who do we target? And when we don't have the correct answer politically, then scapegoating runs wild. And that's why there's so much anti-immigrant and anti-poor people fervor, when actually we should be organizing against those who have too much, not against those who have too little.
Who would you target in those circumstances?
We've got to challenge the de facto oligarchy in this country. Wall Street, those who have enormous wealth. We've got a few hundred people in this country who have as much wealth as half of the population. That's obscene. We've got children who are malnourished, who are homeless, and we've got this inordinate wealth. It ain't right, and we got to change it.
I want to talk about the United States having the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. Yet we demand that other countries not develop nuclear weapons. How do you deal with what appears to be a hypocrisy, a we are holier than thou approach, which many other countries take from their personal perspective?
We cannot effectively tell the world, do as we say, not as we do. By far having the largest nuclear arsenal in the world, the United States is preaching to other countries not to engage in nuclear weaponry development. A reality is that Israel, Pakistan, India, they've gained nuclear weapons. They don't adhere to, they're not signatories to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. They got the weapons largely through the export and propagation of nuclear power, so-called peaceful atom technology. And the U.S. and other exporting powers that are committed to nuclear energy continue to push this technology on the world. So when I went to Iran and talked to people, almost without exception on the streets, they said, well, yes, we want nuclear power. You've got it in the United States. You think you're better than us? So I hope that we can develop a ethos that says, look, we're going to sink or swim on the planet together. We can't tell certain countries effectively, we're going to wield our nuclear weapons and it's forbidden for you to even think about developing them. It just won't work that way. It's not effective.
Well, Norman Solomon, author of a dozen books, former director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and candidate for Congress in the 2nd District in California. I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious, and I want to ask a couple of questions about you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Barry.
The first is, can you tell us about an aha or eureka moment in your life that sticks with you, a philosophy or an idea, concept that you continue to live by?
I'd say the utility of nonviolence, not just as a theory, but in practice. I spent a couple of years organizing sort of Gandhian nonviolence efforts to shut down an operating nuclear power plant in Oregon, the only time or the first time that such large-scale nonviolence had been used to close an operating nuclear plant. And when we, more than 200 of us, were in front of the gates of the nuclear facility and saw the impact of that nonviolent organizing, it was an aha moment. And then a few years later, when a white train carrying Trident, multiply targeted reentry vehicles, nuclear warheads, when that train was stopped by dozens of us nonviolently engaging in civil disobedience, to see a train carrying nuclear weapons capable of incinerating millions of people, in fact, designed to do so, to see that nuclear weapons train literally stopped in its tracks because of the power of nonviolence, that was a transformative moment for me, because if we could, as we did, stop a nuclear weapons train for 2.5 hours, then maybe the nuclear weapons trains could be stopped for 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months. Who knows how long?
And tell us, what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, I'd like to keep learning and keep working with other people to find out what's possible in human terms. Our potential is unrealized, and even our potential to grasp our potential is unrealized. So this is an ongoing project, and that's life.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I'd go back to The Grapes of Wrath. For one thing, it's a vision, it's politics rooted in human experience, and that's what politics should be about. It's not ultimately an exercise in abstraction. It's about human beings and our possibilities to be more human. My mother mentioned to me a statement that her dad used to make occasionally. He'd say, "We're only human, and sometimes not even that." And we're engaging to be more human, and that certainly is a lifelong process.
Well, Norman Solomon, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry.
Norman Solomon is the author of 12 books, the founder and former director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and a candidate for the newly shaped 2nd Congressional District in California. The website for the Institute for Public Accuracy is www.accuracy.org. The website for his congressional campaign is solomonforcongress.com. The book that Norman Solomon recommends is The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onestad is our associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.